What do you like best about the book of Jeremiah? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, and we come to the last in our series on the book of Jeremiah. My conversation partners have been with us the whole time, Dave Thomas, Matilda Fry, from the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Now, I would just like to take that question, and I've got a list of questions I'd like to go down here, but let's start most, if you were to say what I like best about the book of Jeremiah. Now, if you don't like it at all, you can say that, but what do you like best about the book of Jeremiah? We'll give Matilda the first crack at that.
I like best the first verses of chapter 31, where the newness of the new covenant is introduced. But the most impressive aspect to me is in the words where God says, I have loved you with an everlasting love, therefore I have drawn you with loving kindness. So if Jeremiah was called to be a prophet, and God knew him before he was born, and his prophet ministry was a burden. He is called the prophet of doom, the weeping prophet, and so on. But here he is introduced to the loving kindness of God that has drawn him into this place, personally and the people.
Wonderful. Dave?
No, I think that your question is fairly easy to answer. I think it's the verses that talk about the new covenant.
Yeah.
I mean, when you read that, even for the first time, it's electrifying to realize that you might be lost in all the wranglings of Jeremiah and the history and the misbehaviors and the struggles, but this suddenly jumps out as a pure spring of water, so to speak, that just, I might not figure everything else out, but this is very plain and very, very powerful.
Yeah. Well, I've got two prongs here. One, just quickly, I would say, I love the book of Jeremiah because it tells us so much about how a biblical book is put together. That's from the scholarly side. But from the believer's side, Jeremiah 31, that's got to be the cream of the crop. It's the best. It's my favorite verse anywhere in Scripture, and it comes from Jeremiah.
Yeah.
Now, next question. What's most troubling about the book of Jeremiah?
Well, I got something else I like I'm going to put on the table.
Okay. Well, go ahead. Dump it in.
I actually like the dialogue pertaining to Jeremiah's call, you know, and I know he fusses about it, but, you know, there are some professions or functions in life where a sense of calling is absolutely vital, and to see how that played out in Jeremiah's mind, and even to know that God picked him before he was born, that whole dynamic I find very helpful. Even the fact that Jeremiah struggled with it for his whole life, because sometimes a sense of calling is something you struggle with.
You know, it's interesting. We didn't talk about the other call experiences, but Jeremiah's experience where he struggled a lot is like Moses. Moses didn't like his call. It's fascinating. And finally he says, you know, oh, Lord, send someone else. And the Lord gets angry and says, all right, I'll send Aaron, but you're going too. All right. Now, the most troubling thing.
It's troubling when God calls you and it involves you your whole life. It goes
no
to
wife,
the
no
core.
Children. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yes, that's what
wow.
I mean.
Jeremiah 16. It's a...
Yeah.
For me, the most troubling thing in the book of Jeremiah is the way it shows the perversity of the human heart.
Mm.
You know, and it's not just what we talked about last week about, you know, the reasons, the recitation of idol practices. But it boggles my mind that here was a group of people who had this covenant given to them long ago that was supposed to be recited, that was supposed to be lived under, that had a whole list of blessings attached, that if you're faithful to me, says God, these blessings will come. If you're not, these curses will be for you. And what is it about the human heart that for generation after generation, the pathway to blessing is ignored and undermined, even when the curses are falling?
Yeah.
Okay, what does it take to get a human being to turn to God? I mean, when you look in Jeremiah, I understand that this heartened experience of this man, because he was front and center against what I call the perversity of humanity. And you know, people say, well, human beings are these wonderful creatures. If you just let them go, they'll self-actualize, and it's nonsense. OK, Okay. Yep. That the human heart, well, Jeremiah 17, I mean, he says, you know, he talks about the human heart, beware, it's deceitful. It's desperately wicked. Desperately wicked.
Desperately wicked.
It has a thin veneer over it, but watch out, the human heart is a nasty thing.
Well, my challenge with Jeremiah comes in part out of my my own personal devotional life. For many months now, my wife and I have been following a procedure where I read through books of the Bible, various translations, and look for something that I can actually copy out, write out by hand. It's something that we can read for breakfast and share together. And my wife is a very gentle person. Now, Jeremiah is not as bad as Joshua and Judges. You know, that, go through acres of stuff there. But still, that's why when I spot a bright and shining light, I say, oh, that's wonderful. See, but that's probably my most troubling aspect of dealing with the book of Jeremiah. It's such a heavy hand. And what you say is true, Dave. But, boy. Now, what does Jeremiah – I've got down a list of questions, and we're not probably going to be able to go over all of them. But what does the book of Jeremiah tell us about the value of ritual?
It sure tells us about the power of ritual, you know, especially those people who are making cakes for the Queen of Heaven. Yeah. I mean, the ritual is powerful, but the value of it, I don't know. I have to think about that all, and so maybe Matilda or you can speak to it.
Well, it seems to me there comes a point, and maybe this is prophetic overstatement that you mentioned earlier, that you actually have to get rid of some of this stuff. You know, there's one passage in here where God says, there will not be an ark, nor will another one be made, you know, which is an astonishing statement. The sacred symbol, it's going to be gone. See, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. See, and I think of what happens at the end of the book of Psalm 51, which is another editing situation where you find that which God values is the spirit, the heart. But then the last verse comes on, which was apparently added after the destruction of Jerusalem, you know, rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Then we will have right sacrifices again. See, it's such a fascinating contrast, but the biblical writers put them right together there, ritual, but yet content. Mm-hmm. And again, that variation reminds me of what happened when the Berlin Wall came down. They did Beethoven's Ninth. Mm-hmm. And instead of ode to joy, Freude, they changed it to ode to Freiheit, to freedom.
Freedom.
See, because their circumstances were such. So, you know, seeing that dynamic at work here is important. But so ritual is important, but not nearly as important.
Ritual has no value if it does not coincide what is going on inside.
Yep.
Ritual is, I believe, the symbol that what is happening in my heart, in my relationship between God and me, what is happening inside, that is, ritual conveys that to the outside world.
Yeah.
So you can see it in images, ritual symbols and so on. If that does not transpire, then there is no value to it.
Yeah, it's empty ritual.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is indeed a yearning, it seems to me, for common experience. I remember when I was in Germany as a teacher exchange in 1980-81, the Iron Curtain was still up. And they had the Germans, when they're conservative, they tend to be very conservative. When they're liberal, they tend to be very liberal. And they had Wissenschaftlicher Arbeitskreis, Adventistischer Wissenschaftlicher Arbeitskreis, which met at the school there for a weekend. And it was a painful weekend because the liberals would say something and then there would be applause and then the other side would come back. I just wonder, this is the Church of God, how we come together. And there was one exception where all of that counterbalancing applause on one side or the other, when Brother Leutert, who was at our seminary in Friedensau, he had gotten permission to come over there.
Mm-hmm.
And he told about what it was like to be Christians in the atheist state.
Oh, my.
He said, Catholics are still Catholics. Baptists are still Baptists. Adventists are still Adventists. But we are one in Christ Jesus.
Wow.
And that point, there was a common experience.
There was no applause.
No applause. It just was just, you know, lumps in the throat and tears in the eyes, because that's the way we all want it. Okay, let's look at another one of these. What does Jeremiah tell us about hope?
Well, if he writes the book of doom, there is an explosion of hope, especially when we come to those chapters that we talked about, the new promised covenant of God. Yeah. So there is both in the book.
And it's interesting that when he promises a return, that is a hope, you know. Mm-hmm. And so while he couldn't promise them delivery from the Babylonians, he told them to go, but he still said, I'm going to purchase a piece of property. Mm. We will be coming back.
Yeah, I think he teaches us that in the midst of even the worst adversity, because of the actions of God, there is hope.
Yeah.
There is hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of the things I love about Christianity. It injects hope into the world and into life. How do you live without hope?
And, in fact, Romans says, for in hope we were saved. Now, hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? Mm-hmm. But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it. Yeah. With patience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we've got just a few minutes left. One last word of whatever you would like to say about Jeremiah. And you've got 37 seconds to say it.
Well, I mean, it's a long book. And it's, you know, it's history. It's kind of hard to figure out all the kings and all of that.
Yeah.
But to me, I see it as a book that arises out of great tragedy. The end of all things, so to speak, is upon them. But it's also the book of a great God, and I mean, I would end up with that covenant promise that is in there.
Yep. Matilda.
Well, in this book, we have a pagan king who is God's servant. Nebuchadnezzar is called. Yeah, he is his servant. Yeah. And that is basically Jeremiah's trial that he faces his whole life, that he talks about this enemy of his own people, but it is God who has chosen him to, first of all, they should submit to him, they should be quiet and accept the calamity, the destruction and everything, and go even with them into captivity, into exile.
Yeah.
And God works through all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that connection, God is over all.
Yes.
Yeah, he is the sovereign God, and I think that's the most important thing. Well, thanks a bunch to both of you. This has been great fun, and may the Lord be with you as you continue to ponder Jeremiah. My thanks to David Olson, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in for The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.